This is The Human and the Machine, brought to you by Editorial Intelligence.
Hello, and welcome back to The Human and the Machine, Series 2, and a warm welcome if you're joining us for the first time. I'm Julia Hobsbawm. This podcast looks at everything connected to technology and humans. That's the hardware, the software, the how, the who, the what, and the why of the way in which technology infiltrates and either improves our lives or gives us reason to disapprove of and even distrust it. Each episode, our guests help us ask and hopefully answer one abiding question from different perspectives and angles. And this is the question: who is in control, the human or the machine? And what's the best and worst of tech bringing us?
Time is precious as a human being. We only have so much of it. I don't want to be sitting behind a screen at all. I call my life off the screen.
So that was Steve, a tech-averse individual from San Francisco, which is where our first episode comes from, and where we went to interview Hannah Kutschler, who covers the technology beat for the Financial Times.
What we got instead is more of a moral crash and a crisis and a big tech backlash, which was looking at, okay, well, we have all these tools, we've managed to spread them incredibly quickly around the world. What damage could they actually be causing?
And then it was back to London, and the Ritz, no less, where we talked about the very human side of living with technology at work with Aaron Ain, head of the human capital software firm Kronos Incorporated, whose products touch the lives of 40 million workers every day throughout the world.
If you forgot your mobile device and you're halfway to work, you turn around and go home and get your mobile device. And so it's evidence to me that people want to stay connected. And so then how do we help them stay connected in a way that meets their particular needs?
That's all ahead during the next half an hour, right here on The Human and the Machine. Stay with us. The Human and the Machine is in association with Social Health Expert. That's a URL of socialhealth.expert, which helps organisations and businesses make their interactions with technology productive, creative and manageable in the always-on era. So here we are, 6 months after our last series, and no, the world has not stopped turning in tech terms, and the story is faster than ever. If there's a word for every program, let's begin with this word, petaflop. It's the speed at which computing can now operate per second, and it's fast, super fast. Think of a number followed by 15 zeros, and you have a petaflop. All of which means, well, no stopping, no turning back. And not everyone is happy about that, as I discovered in a bookshop in San Francisco.
I don't have a cell phone or a computer. I'm more into biological analog time. Time is precious as a human being. We only have so much of it. I don't want to be sitting behind a screen at all. I call my life off the screen. And I protest the software engineers that are designing the addiction to this technology for their profit and our loss.
How long have you had that stance? You presumably once had a mobile phone. How long have
No,
you...
No, I never have.
So you...
I have a landline, and in Sacramento, California, the telecommunication companies are trying to take our landlines away. With a landline, you have much more privacy. You need a search warrant, more or less, to listen to somebody who's on a landline versus a mobile phone, which anybody can tune in and listen to you. So there is a compromising of our privacy. People are too readily available to give up the privacy in their inner world. And I think these technologies are trying to invade the inner world of our psyche. And I think the biggest danger with artificial intelligence and all these platforms that are coming out is to make the machine think for the human being. When we cannot think anymore and we rely on machines, I'm afraid humanity is going to lose its evolutionary goals.
How much of what you believe is a conspiracy theory and how much of it is principle and politics?
It's both. Conspiracy means to breathe together. The people in this room are drawn to this room because we have a similarity in our philosophy of life. And that is to maintain inner integrity. During the 1960s, Tim spoke about inner freedom, But he also said to keep your head low, which means if you put your head out there too much, the system will knock it off.
Steve, what do you do in the real world?
I design my own hats. I'm sort of a non-professional artist and a photographer. In fact, in this very building, in the 1965-66, Lawrence Ferlinghetti exhibited my photographs here because I photographed the protest against the war in Vietnam, which I left the United States at age 20 on my bicycle, and I headed for the Holy Lands.
Now, I'm just going to finish by being slightly contrarian to say that if any world has been positively transformed by the digital, you could say it is the world of photography, or do you disagree? I mean, it's shared so much more.
Well, that's one medium of many mediums.
So you don't mind the digital medium, but you mind aspects of the big businesses behind those mediums?
Well, you know, the digital arts have their own expressions, but I was always involved with analog. When I stopped photographing, I was doing analog. I'm not involved with the digital world at all. I put my cameras down. It's a question of artistic choice. I felt digital was commercial. I felt digital was flat.
So you're a purist. Well, I'm a artistic purist.
I'm a Virgo.
So I'm also sitting next to Murray. Where do you stand on technology and the digital and the human?
I think it's great, and I really have embraced it because I guess I am more looking for the future, and I embrace change. We have come so far in so many areas through technology.
Are you a physicist by nature?
No, but I've been in data processing all my life, and I was actually moved out here with the company. And I actually was in charge of a large company and had all the external marketing databases. We were the first ones to get the Apple computer. We got Lisa. I mean, you can tell how old I am now. We were the first ones to start buying personal computers. And I can remember in my apartment, we asked each other, would you buy one of these? And we said no, because we had to use BASIC. We had to write our own programs. And then all of a sudden, they had Lotus. And then they had WordPerfect, and I can remember saying, by the time I went to graduate school, I was saying, how did anybody go to graduate school without a personal computer? At our age, we went to the Wilson Library to study, and now the kids have their computer, they're doing the research on the computer, personal computer, they're writing their reports. When I went to graduate school, I thought it was wonderful by the time I had a personal computer because I could write reports, save it, come back later, re-edit it. You know, it just made life so much easier. But it's gotten so technical that it is leaving a lot of the people, older people, out now because with these passwords, at their age, they can't remember anything, let alone passwords, and they're leaving out a whole market, and it's leaving, you know, really the older people completely who've been working at trade jobs such as steel mills and other things, and they lost their jobs, and how did they all of a sudden learn all the technology? Okay. So it's been very difficult for older people to adjust.
This is the human and the machine.
That was Stephen Murray, recorded in City Lights Bookstore, famous in the 1960s when everyone was tuning in and dropping out and no one had a personal computer of any kind. I was here in San Francisco for two reasons. One, I was en route to Silicon Valley for the Social Science Foo Conference, more of which in the next program. But I also came to talk to one of the technology journalists we at The Human and the Machine find most interesting, who covers her beat in a way which makes you realize she's not missing a beat herself, Hannah Kuchler of the Financial Times. We wanted her take on what's Silicon Valley doing these days.
So I arrived here 4 days before Twitter filed its S-1 and published its IPO documents. And so that was, you know, that was a big time of excitement about tech. You know, within 6 months, Facebook was buying WhatsApp, it was buying drone companies, it was buying Oculus, the virtual reality company. And then for a while, the big concern was actually about a financial crash. You know, all this money is pouring into these companies, many of which never seem to want to go public. Are they going to have to batten down the hatches at some point? And in fact, what we got instead, and you know, maybe the jury is still out on that, what we got instead is more of a moral crash and a crisis and a big tech backlash, which was looking at, okay, well, we have all these tools, we've managed to spread them incredibly quickly around the world. What damage could they actually be causing?
I think that's right, but now we're, or the risk is, there is going to be a financial crash too, right? I mean, you have a lot of IPOs coming up, and the Financial Times is covering in great detail the analysis that maybe they're not going to hit their spot.
Yeah, I mean, that you can debate about whether that is about the wider macroeconomic situation, you know, monetary easing, all sorts of things that I'm definitely not the FT's expert in, rather than the tech industry itself. I think that some of these companies could not go public if they didn't want to. In fact, they're probably just trying to hit the sweet spot before there is a broader economic crisis. So the companies that are going public this year, as far as we know, are Uber, which is obviously going to be, you know, just the biggest one by far.
Slack.
Lyft, Slack, and perhaps Pinterest as well. And these are companies that are actually quite old for the Valley. They're all over 10 years old, I think.
Back to your point about the moral difficulty, just while I'm recording this a few days ago, Pinterest and indeed Instagram came under criticism for encouraging sharing of images harmful to suicidal teenagers. So this problem of the perception that Silicon Valley has spawned really a very devilish trend isn't going to go away, is it?
No, because these are actually very difficult problems to fix. I mean, in some ways, I have a lot of sympathy for some of the people at these companies, because you create this, basically, this entire world. You know, it grows really fast. You have to rush and catch up and put in place laws. I mean, Facebook this week was talking about how it could create its own sort of independent Supreme Court. You have to put in place these armies of moderators to protect it. And by being global, you've assumed that there is something much more in common culturally and legally across the world than there actually is. But, of course, my sympathy also has massive limits, because sometimes this has been a case of going after profits rather than paying attention to any of these problems when they were first coming up.
It's also, though, the case that the consumer used to be much more passive in an era of mass entertainment, the television era, the movies, where really we just had to sit back and watch. And now, of course, we've been participating. How much do you think the public is recognising they have a bigger choice and a bigger role? The human is not, in fact, at the mercy of the algorithm-led machine as much as we like to think that we are.
I don't know if I agree with you. I think that maybe we are. I think that there's obviously been lots of movements to try and restrict how much time you spend on your smartphone, social media. There are measurement devices. There are people trying to, you know, do detox, digital detoxes. But I think that's really restricted to the same kind of people that do, you know, real life detoxes, to people who are sort of
the privileged, the literate, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. The people in, you know, Western countries with enough money, enough time, well-informed enough to make a choice, and who are always thinking, how could this be affecting my brain, my social interactions, my relationships, my understanding of the world? And I don't think that that's yet reached everybody else. And I think that the companies do have a responsibility to try and help people on an individual basis.
So my final question for you is, how do you see the next 6 months? You've been here for nearly 6 years. What do you think the trend is overall in technology in Silicon Valley? Are we going to effectively see more of the same, or more of the same with IPOs here and there and a little bit of regulation, or is something else on the horizon that we haven't really figured out yet?
I think the interesting thing is that everyone is waiting for the next big platform. You know, the iPhone has been around for 12 years. iPhone was obviously not the first smartphone, but it was a mass adopting thing that created this whole app ecosystem. We haven't got something else yet. And so we will obviously see the fruition of some companies which are based on the iPhone. You know, you couldn't have had Uber if you didn't have the smartphone in that kind of form. And we will see some regulation, I think, although I think that that's down to unity in governments and regulators, which we're a little bit sorely lacking at the moment. And I think that there are some really interesting potential developments around, you know, using data and AI in new areas like healthcare, but those are not going to come to fruition in the next 6 months.
That was Hannah Kuchler of the Financial Times.
This is The Human and the Machine, brought to you by Editorial Intelligence.
Next up was Wheels Up, and back in London, I caught up with Aaron Ain, who heads up Kronos Incorporated, a billion-dollar software business which affects the daily working lives of 40 million people. Aaron has written an autobiography, Work Inspired. I asked him about how humans and machines can and do work together, and whether it's all upside.
We all live with devices today that keep us connected. And I used to think that it was whether people wanted to or didn't want to, but I've come to believe now that people want to. I tell people that if you leave your home and you come to work and you forget your badge to start the process of going to work, you keep going and you tell your manager, I forgot my badge. But if you forgot your mobile device and you're halfway to work, you turn around and go home and get your mobile device. And so it's evidence to me that people want to stay connected. And so then how do we help them stay connected in a way that meets their particular needs?
One of the things I'm struck by is that you don't appear to feel any tension between who your worker that you're serving is as an individual with a life and who they are at work. And that has what has made Kronos itself an extremely successful, popular company. Can you tell me a little bit about those? Because it is unusual.
Sure. So I believe that the most important thing in people's lives shouldn't be where they work. I think it should be their families. It's just a personal belief I have. And so I tell the 6,000 or so people who work at Kronos every day that they should strive for work-life balance, and we support their desire and need for work-life balance. And in some ways, I demand that they go and find a balanced way to work and continue to stay connected to their families, particularly in this fully connected 24/7 world. You can lose sight of what's really most important. And for us, that means that we trust each other. It means that we communicate with each other. It means that we're transparent with each other. It means that we're honest and open with each other. And for me, that's liberating. And I think it has directly related to our positive outcomes and how we've been successful in what we do. And
that, I mean, it's no mean feat to be listed on Forbes' list of great places to work when you're not in, may I say, the sexiest place in the world. You're in quite a quiet part of the East Coast. You're not in Silicon Valley. So you have built a rapport with your workers, which is quite unusual.
Sure. And so we do it because it reflects our values, but we also do it because it helps our business drive forward. It helps us recruit great people and retain great people. So I think it's wonderful when things are meaningful to you personally as a leader, and they also serve your business needs. And when you can bring those together, the outcomes can be magical, and that's what we try to do every day. And our workers recognize that by rating us as a top place to work on Glassdoor and Fortune and Forbes, while we're competing with all these other organizations around the U.S. and around the world.
One of the things that particularly interests me is the encroachment of technology into the daily lives of workers, even technology companies that produce products such as Kronos. Their workers can be stressed by the amount of email or the Slack conversations. I mean, how have you handled the fact that every single workplace is now always on with technology? Has that ever given you cause for concern?
It doesn't give me personal cause for concern, because I don't think it's the organizations that drive that. I think it's the individual people. I think people like to be connected, or they choose to be connected. in terms of what they want to do. For me, for example, when I get home on Friday afternoon, I completely tune out of all those things. And
me
I
too.
Tune back in on like on a Sunday. So I do it. Doesn't mean there's not a lot of messages when I tune back in, but I know other people who can't put their devices down and their organizations aren't making them do that. They choose to do that.
But in some organizations, there's a culture of always on. And in fact, Kronos commissioned some work that I took part in that was about the always on culture. So you're alive to the fact that workplaces have got to set some boundaries.
So I think workplaces need to set some boundaries. And what we try to do is, to the extent that they want to have a modern way to communicate with their staff and their staff wants a modern way to communicate with others who they work with as well as their leadership, we create tools that allow them to do that. But at some point, the users of the devices and the users of the tools have to make a decision how they want to use it. And so we're not trying to advocate that people be on all the time. Rather, we're just trying to facilitate if they do that. So, for example, I think it's an advantage if someone is at home in the evening and they can't remember what their schedule is for tomorrow. In the old days, it used to be posted up on a board at the office, and they might have to call a whole bunch of people. Do you know when I'm coming in? Do you remember what was posted? Now they can go to their mobile device and see instantly that, oh yeah, I'm supposed to start at 8:30. That's an advantage. Or if they can't come to work and they want to find someone else to swap shifts with them, we help automate that. So I think we make things easier in that way if they choose to use it.
My final point to you is something you mention in your book about being an unleader, which I think is the most refreshing thing I've ever read by somebody who clearly is a leader. What did you mean by being an unleader?
Sure. I think as leaders, we sometimes get too consumed in who we are. We think too much of ourselves. We read too much about the things people might write about us. And I think we forget that person-to-person interaction is the most important thing. And so I am very conscious of making sure that I find ways to connect with people who I work with. And I don't describe myself in my role as CEO of Kronos. When people ask me what I do, I say, oh, I'm in the software business. Oh, what kind of software business? And no, enterprise software. And it'll take a couple dozen questions if someone is persistent to really get out of me what I actually do. Because being CEO of Kronos doesn't define who I am. And so I lead my life that way. And I believe humility can go a long way towards driving performance and getting along with people better. So a little example for me as a leader or an unleader is when I walk around the halls where I work, I don't have my nose in my mobile device. It's in my pocket. And I'm talking to everyone I'm interacting with, asking them how they're doing, how their families are, what they're working
on. It's a wonderful Yiddish term for it that you use in your book, kibitzing.
Yep, and so I'm really good at that. And so even when I've had a really busy day and it's 2 p.m, I'll say I need a half hour break and I'll tell my assistant I'll be gone for a half hour and I'll go to a different floor in the building. I'll just walk around and do it and just chat with people. And so it allows me to be more connected with people and to be more accessible and to hear what's really going on. And I don't actually do it for a business reason. I do it for a personal reason. It's just the right thing to do. I'm no better than anybody else. None of us are better than each other. And this is why my way to set an example and to lead my life in a way that I choose that is important to me. And does it have benefits for me as a leader in the company? Sure it does. But is that the overriding reason why I do it? No, I do it when I'm out of work also. It's just who I am, and I think it's important.
This is the Human at the Machine.
Now, before we close this episode, here's a new thing for Series 2. Each week, we're going to throw a spotlight on a digital business or product aimed at transforming human lives for the better. Here's Tony Mannering of Qdos.
Qdos is an app to help individuals develop their life skills and their soft skills, which are so important for their success and for that of their organisations and therefore employers as well as individuals.
And normally these kind of services, effectively coaching and mentoring, have had to be delivered quite laboriously, quite expensively, face-to-face, one-on-one. So am I right that this app is going to enlarge the pool of access to these skills?
Absolutely. So If we think about it, coaching and mentoring brings great insight and benefit to many people. But those people tend to be top executives or people in society who have behavioral problems and challenges and benefit from particular interventions funded by government and charities and other organizations. What Kudus does is to harness the opportunity of digital and to take those insights of coaching and mentoring and to put them on an app, a mentor in your pocket, if you will.
So Kudus is aiming to be a mass take-up, mass market app, of course. Who are your escalators going to be? How are you going to reach a large number of people from individual downloads or from something else?
So accountants, lawyers, nurses, engineers, all of those are in professional membership organisations. All of those need soft skills. Indeed, increasingly, those professional bodies recognise the soft skills challenge, but also opportunity for their members. And what we will be doing is enabling those members to focus their continuing professional development, their CPD, on soft skills, any place, any time, on Kudus, the app.
Am I right, Tony, that the USP of Kudus is fundamentally that it is offering downloadable guides to a set of both qualities and skills? In other words, this is not hard training, is it? It's not qualifications such as you'd know it in computer programming. It's qualities and skills that you need as people.
It's the soft skills, it's the life skills that we need to succeed in a world where we need to be increasingly agile, where most of the jobs that we'll be doing in the future may not even exist at the moment. And it's really who we are as much as what we do that will determine our success and that of our organisations and our society. Soft skills can boost lifetime earnings by 14%. So in every way that we look at individual, at business, and societal success, soft skills is the agenda that delivers that success.
Next episode, I'm back in the Valley, Silicon Valley, in the belly of the tech beast and at Facebook's HQ, no less, where I attended the social science Foo Camp. Here's a taste.
When we look at Google Translate, we see that occupations that are associated with women are always translated as she, and occupations such as doctor that has a different ranking than nurse is always translated as a he.
More from Foo Camp, and yes, I got the t-shirt, next episode. Meanwhile, that's it for this episode of The Human and the Machine. Many thanks for listening. Like us, listen to us in all the usual places, iTunes, Acast, SoundCloud. Check out Series 1 and share your connections. The Human and the Machine is an editorial intelligence production in association with socialhealth.expert. And the sound editor is George McDonough. It is written and presented by me, Julia Hobsbawm, and this episode was put together in San Francisco, Menlo Park, and London.